Jeff Bloom from Murphy & Rood Malting joins me this week to discuss craft malting. This is Beersmith Podcast number 227.
This is the Beersmith Home Brewing Show, where brewing great beer is our passion. If you want to take your brewing to the next level, visit beersmith.com, where you can download a trial version of our Beersmith software, subscribe to the newsletter, and get dozens of free articles on home brewing. And now, your host and the author of Home Brewing with Beersmith, Brad Smith.
This is Beersmith Podcast number 227, and it's early December 2020. Jeff Bloom from Murphy & Rood Malting joins me this week to discuss craft malting. Thank you to this week's sponsors, Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Every issue of Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine is packed with articles for homebrewers and beer lovers. They're offering access to videos, brewing courses, exclusive articles, and the amazing Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Go to beerandbrewing.com to get your subscription today. And also the Brew Commander, the new brewhouse controller from Blickman Engineering. It's available in electric and gas propane models. The patent-pending Brew Commander is a high-quality brewhouse controller that offers automated step mashing, boil timers, precision temperature control, and advanced settings. Command your brew day with a new Brew Commander. To order yours today, go to BlickmanEngineering.com. Again, that's BlickmanEngineering.com. And finally, I urge you to give the new Beersmith 3.1 update a try. If you've not downloaded the new update, grab it now as it includes improved data storage, additional dry hop options, new mash pH models, new add-ons, and more. To download your free 21-day trial, go to beersmith.com today. Again, that's beersmith.com. And now let's jump into this week's episode. Today on the show, I welcome first-time guest Jeff Bloom. Jeff is the founder and head maltster at Murphy & Rood Malting Company in Charlottesville, Virginia. Opening its doors in 2018, Murphy & Rood is Virginia's first and only dedicated commercial specialty malt house, now producing over 25 base, high kiln, crystal, and dry roast malts for regional brewers and distillers. Jeff, it's great to have you on the show. How are you doing?
I'm good, Brad. Thanks for having me. It's nice to see you.
I'm glad you're able to take some time out of your busy day. Can you start by telling us a little bit about how you decided to dive into craft malting?
Yeah, it was really the surprise of a wholly untapped and frankly non-existent supply chain, despite the rampant growth in Virginia craft beverage markets. You know, that curiosity, which I thought there was probably a laundry list of suppliers supporting these craft beverage producers, and it, you know, turned out to not be that way. And so that curiosity took me down the path of small grain agriculture, and I started in earnest attending small grain field days, typically put on by Virginia Tech at some of their test plot locations across the state. Building some small pilot malting equipment, and it took me a few years to begin building an established farmer network. And at the end of 2017, we went into construction of our now 6,000 square foot craft malt house in Charlottesville here. And here we are.
And are you the only craft malt house in Virginia?
I'm the only dedicated commercial production malt house. We do have a couple maltsters here in Virginia, mostly that produce for their own use. So whether it is for their own spirits or their own craft beer. So I am what I like to call the one malting for the people, if you will.
And what's your background, Jeff? Are you did you get interested in this because you're a home brewer, like craft beer distilleries? I don't know.
I had dabbled with home brewing. I really wasn't, terribly good at it at the time. I had brewed a few batches with a buddy of mine, here, but really the background I had is less glamorous. I mean, I didn't come from some family farm that has been operating since the 1800s. I did not, I did not get a degree in ag sciences or anything like that. It's really, mostly that I was taken down this path of, curious small grain agriculture. You know, I really come from a corporate background in corporate growth, working for a government consulting firm for a little over a decade, and prior to that, some grant making. So I really, you know, the bridge to malting was a fairly random one, though it has certainly become my calling for sure.
So kind of like me, you wanted to do something a little different, huh?
Yeah. And I mean, I didn't really intentionally go down this path. You know, the research kind of turned into some practice around here and some building of small equipment. And then, you know, before you know it, you're in your basement at 3 a.m. turning grain, wondering what on earth you're doing up. I'm sure we can all.
You were talking a little bit before the show, but I think you mentioned that a friend of yours maybe got you thinking down this road.
Yeah, a good friend of mine, Brian Morse, actually, at the years ago, was potentially thinking about opening a distillery. He had actually had a forestry degree and was an orchardist by trade. And our conversation over a beer one afternoon turned into actually how scary it would be to become a craft brewery or a craft spirits producer here in Virginia, given all of the manic growth that was going on at the time, and really thinking that perhaps the supply chain was a more interesting and needed capacity here. And so, you know, I went home and I looked into it and kind of was focused more on some of the infusion spirits that were going on at the time. And I, you know, went looking around for malt and hops, and it really wasn't happening quite yet. And, you know, years down the road, you just kind of find yourself where you are, I guess.
So tell us a little bit about the company. How'd you set it up? What does it look like?
Yeah, so we're actually I designed and built Murphy & Rood Malt House really as a specialty malt house. It's a bit unlike many of the other craft malt houses across the country. I think we're numbering close to 70 or so at this point. That we built the malt house for full capability. So we've got a full capability kiln, a drum roaster, crystal production. We really did design our facility to be able to produce a wider range of products. And the model was really built on enabling brewers and distillers to weave our products into their current production in a variety of ways, as opposed to trying to force a decision around moving all of their supply to us. They would be able to weave us in and kind of select where they want to use some of our products with perhaps what they're already comfortable using at the time. It's a margin game in brewing. I think we're probably going to get into this a little bit later, but product pricing is quite a bit different on our side. So this really gave us the flexibility to meet our customers where they are.
So when you say specialty malts, do you mean you focus more on the specialty malts as opposed to maybe some of the base malts? Or
yeah, believe it or not, I had opened the malt house with the intention of producing and selling base malts really for the only first year, and then moving almost entirely to specialty malts. So that meaning more of the special use malts, high kiln, Viennas and Munichs, crystals, high color dry roast, your browns and your chocolate malts. We also do biscuits and some aromatic malts, but and different applications in that. And believe it or not, I didn't see it coming, but we are still very, very high volume in our base malts. We offer quite a few, from Pilsner to pale to an English pale or a pale ale malt. And so we have really been pleasantly surprised with the demand of our base malts as well as our specialty stuff. So, the best laid plans, I suppose, but I couldn't be happier with where we are.
That's awesome. Tell us a little bit about the malting process. How do you source your barley? What type of process are you using? What type of equipment are you using? I know a lot of malt houses, craft houses, end up creating a lot of their own equipment too, right?
Yeah, and ours is really no different. I mean, we have a mishmash of different, you know, either professionally designed and fabricated or, you know, kind of pieced together equipment. As many new businesses do, you know, we were limited in what we were able to, you know, either fit into 6,000 square feet or what we were able to raise during the initial capital raise for the malt house. And so you're limited there. You know, we do take a Virginia first approach to small grain sourcing. Not to say that we are bound within the boundaries of Virginia, but we really certainly try to stay within the Commonwealth when we can. You know, Mother Nature or other unforeseen circumstances may dictate us going out of state. Given the structure of kind of the contract growing that goes on here, there's not much of a spot market, though that is getting better. But so we, you know, we are really relationship driven and utilize a network of small grain farmers across the state to kind of accommodate variances in climate or weather. And so we don't have all of our eggs in one particular basket, if you will.
Mm-hmm. So that's on the sourcing end. Can you walk us through the typical malting process that you go through?
Sure. And there's, you know, there's many different ways to do this. The primary stages of malting include a steep stage where we're increasing the moisture content within the grain. We then move that to germination where most of the time is spent germinating that grain to coax out enzymes that are later used by the brewer to convert starches to fermentable sugars. And then there's also the kilning process, of course, which dries down the grain, provides a lot of the flavor differentiation in malts. We, like I mentioned earlier, also have a drum roaster where we produce a lot of our, obviously our dark color dry roast malts, but also is a component of our crystal production. But so getting back to the process, I mean, there's a multitude of ways to kind of combine those steps into a production facility. You can steep and germinate in the same vessel. You can steep separately and germinate and kiln in the same vessel. You can do all three in the same vessel, which is what many maltsters are utilizing drum maltings for. We do it the hard way, I suppose, and we separate all of those processes out. So we steep. We steep in a completely re-engineered and refabricated 120 barrel fermenter, which has been wow. completely broken down and built up back up again. We germinate in a Saladin box within a walk-in cooler, actually. We kind of condition the air around the box and manage fresh air and CO2 that way, but we're actually controlling the climate around the box as opposed to just the air going onto the grain. And then we kiln, obviously, in a separate kiln, and then bag and pallet and out the door as quick as we can.
Sounds somewhat complicated.
We would have it no other way.
Yeah. and I mean, how much production are you producing now? You mentioned 120 barrel fermenter. That's a monster, right?
Yeah. So the malt house is actually set up for five ton batches. The 120 barrel fermenter can steep roughly 5 tons of raw grain. Our kiln is also sized and spec'd for a 5 ton batch of green malt. The limiting factor, and this was obviously on purpose, is that we germinate in a 2.5 ton Saladin box with the intention of dropping a second Saladin box next to that, which will then bring us up to that full production size. So we built the malt house to essentially grow into. So we're maximizing our production that we're built to it right now with plans to expand in place. So we had some interesting happenings along the way. I mean, we, you know, that Saladin box I was speaking of was,
well, what are some of the lessons learned, I guess?
Yeah. So, I mean, we built that to 3 tons and 3 tons does not fit in it. We were about 6 inches short on the height of the box. So, despite all of the number crunching, we had to decrease our batch size by about a half a ton, which is, you know, it is what it is. But what we did end up having to do is we run much more concurrent batches. So we're steeping in roughly every 3 days or so. And this will very much improve once we drop a second box. Our expansion plans include replacement of the current box with two separate 5-ton Saladin boxes, which will more or less be able to, will allow us to about quadruple our capacity at full run.
What are you doing now? You're doing maybe 2.5-ton batches and then every 3 days? I don't know.
Yep, 2.5 tons every 3 days. It's limiting in that we can only run one batch at a time, which can be mind-numbing when you are trying to produce, you know, 25 different malts. I mean, I make too many malts, let's be honest. But
I was going to say, then you got to rotate that production schedule between all the different malts, right?
Exactly. And as we're, you know, as we're getting some years under our belt, and awareness is growing, and our reputation, I hope, is preceding us. We spent a lot of time making sure we were just putting out really good stuff. It has admittedly gotten a little bit hard to keep the racks full, but thanks to a very understanding craft brewery and distillery customers, we are able to do all we can and hit as many brew day deliveries as we need to.
So you're getting ready to double production, right? And how long does it take to finish a batch from end to end? Is it 3 days?
So end to end, it's roughly 7. We essentially overlap our steps. So we're on the busiest day, we are loading the kiln, cleaning the germ box, and then refilling that germ box with steeped out grain all in the same day. So we are really, the tolerances between batches is very, very tight, which I enjoy. We're pumping out as much as we possibly can. It doesn't leave a lot of room for mistakes, but hopefully we've gotten most of our mistakes out of our system by now. And so we went from roughly 150, maybe 100, 150 malt tons per year to well over 200. So we're in a good place despite the limited production volume that we have. I'm happy with what we're doing.
Well, let's switch gears and talk about some of the other things, like working with the craft maltsters. Before the show, you mentioned you have, with the craft brewers. Mm-hmm. Before the show, you mentioned you have a Mill Fresh program, which emphasizes the use of fresh ingredients. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, this was a campaign we released this summer. And luckily everybody had plenty of time to see it, I hope, given the COVID environment we've been living in. But this is really our way of promoting conscious sourcing in brewing and distilling. This is different than calls for ethical or sustainable sourcing that you can see in fashion and in different trades like coffee and chocolate. When we say conscious sourcing, we really do mean more breaking out of the habitual, almost robotic methods of ordering raw materials that are, and really giving some thought to what is available closer to home. Anybody who's, any pro brewers that have worked in a brewery for any amount of time, and even on the home brewing front, I mean, it's an easy thing to do is to kind of just assume the malts are just there and everything else is what we play with. That really is no longer the case. And so if we can break folks out of just that kind of robotic computer, drop down box, fill cart, make the pallet a full skid for $150 flat rate shipping, if we can really encourage brewers and distillers to think about what is being produced around them and produced with products that are closer to home, we can really start to, and for all intents and purposes, decommoditize the what we consider to be craft. And so getting kind of to the fresh component of Mill Fresh, the choosing ingredients intentionally, that helps us to shorten and strengthen supply chains. But when it's getting to the freshness of products, we're then talking about flavor impacts, and really, you know, trying to decide to choose the malt that's less traveled, really. If you think about it, you know, there are thousands of chemical compounds associated with flavor in malts, and malts, particularly highly kilned and roasted malts, these contain flavor compounds that increase in volatility as the kiln or the roaster temperature and the time at those temperatures increases. And it's this volatility that really results in flavor loss when malts are stored improperly or perhaps or traveled too long or in shipment too long. So, yeah, I mean, you know, I'll go on the record saying malts shipped from halfway around the world or the country, and for that matter, are inherently prone to flavor loss. Mm-hmm. You know, I do believe when you open a bag up of our chocolate malt, the aroma hits you much differently than it would in a commodity brand malt. But, you know, this is combining the intentional sourcing and the flavor contributions of freshness to really try to open eyes around raw material supply chains in craft brewing and distilling.
And of course, I think one of your other advantages is you have the ability to maybe start with other base ingredients or explore techniques that maybe larger maltsters can't really play with, right?
You know, the small batch side of this is a very good one. It allows us to do one-off and special release batches with much less risk on our side. We can experiment with new grains. We can you know, keep our finger on the pulse of agriculture here and see new varieties or different types of small grains coming down the pike and be able to integrate those and get those through the malt house relatively quickly. And then allow the market to kind of tell us where to go with those things, as opposed to, you know, running a test, you know, 400 ton batch.
Yeah, I'm with you. Well, you mentioned the flavors are very important. And, you know, one of the advantages of a small craft brewery, of course, is you can get fresh ingredients to the brewer much quicker. How have you started working with the craft breweries and even home brewers to integrate local and craft malts into their brewing process?
It really does start with a conversation, I think. I mean, one of the great upsides of craft malting is that you actually communicate with the folks that are physically making the malts. And so we're very, of course, intimately aware of how they're produced, what grain varieties they're produced from and why, the specs on that raw grain, how we get it to its final either modification levels or flavor components. And then we're also intimately aware with how these malts will play in a beer recipe. And so being able to convey from a brewer standpoint what you're looking for in a finished product and talk to us about what of our products may be the best fit for that is something that is not always available to brewers, pro or home brewer level, the way ingredients are offered now. So we certainly obviously start with the conversation. Next piece, and I think we're going to get into some of the malt sensory stuff we do, but we do encourage brewers, and we actually invite them to our malt house to walk through sensory sessions to the extent of actually bringing recipes in. We can steep them out in the gross bill percentages that they intend to utilize, and then they can see what that wort will taste like before they mash in 5 or 7 or 10 barrels of it. So,
and that I think you're using the ASBC method, right? Is that correct?
Correct.
Yeah. The hot steep method. Yeah. Explain what that is, real quick. Some folks may not be familiar.
Yeah. So this is a very exciting and frankly innovating tool. You know, given 2020, that this is groundbreaking is funny sometimes to think about, but it's incredible. The folks at Brees, along with folks from Draft Lab and the Craft Maltsters Guild and others, developed a process for essentially replacing what has historically known as the Congress mash, which is a full conversion mash, and it's really, you know, utilized more for lab analytics than sensory. The hot steep method shortens that mash to essentially a single infusion, 15-minute malt tea, if you will, that allows you to extract the color and the flavor of those malts, but without the very palate fatiguing sweetness that a Congress mash would typically give you. And so you're able to very quickly assess flavor notes within a given malt, and also along the range of intended grist percentages. So it allows you to taste a chocolate malt at, 15% inclusion, which is much more realistic for brewing, as opposed to steeping out 100% chocolate malt, giving that a taste and saying, wow, that's what it's going to taste like in my beer. Cause it certainly is not.
People can do this at home too, right? Explain the method, maybe the real abbreviated method. I guess there's a couple variants, I think, but
sure. So, we actually do these in half size forms, but I'll give the full size, method. You essentially take 50 grams of a base malt. If you were doing something like a high kiln specialty, like a Vienna or a Munich, light or dark Munich, or even a light roasted malt like a biscuit, what you would do is, for those higher kiln or low color roasts, you would do about a 50-50 inclusion with 50% base malt, 50% that specialty malt. If you're trying to do flavor sensory on darker roasts, you would do a 15% inclusion. With just your base malts, you'd be doing a 100% just across the board sensory. So you're taking 50 grams of base malt, or in the case of a high kiln or low color roast, 25 grams of base malt and 25 grams of that specialty. Or what the math is, I believe it's 7.5 grams to the 42.5 grams of base malt for a dark color. And so you are steeping those together. You're just running them through a coffee grinder or a burr mill, putting them in a thermos for 15 minutes with mash temperature water, filtering that through a coffee filter into any vessel of your choosing, and then allowing that to filter off maybe 5, 10, 15 minutes, and then tasting that steep out. That is the truest sense of what you would be getting in a mash environment.
Mm-hmm. And a great project for clubs as well. So that gives you a good idea of what it tastes like. And as you mentioned, you bring the craft brewers in to do that as well. I had another question, which is, how do you, what kind of QA testing are you doing to, verify that your malts are, convertible, have the enzymes, all the other stuff?
Right. So it's two stages. We have a third party lab that we send our samples off to after every batch. We also do some in-house testing. We test for moisture, color, extract. We do a single infusion Congress mash for our extract analysis. Mm-hmm. And so 15 minutes into that, we test for starch conversion with just a simple iodine test. And so we're able to move things out the door with relative confidence if we do not yet have lab analysis back. We do move out to labs to pull numbers for things like friability, alpha amylase, diastatic power, and other things. Beta-glucan.
And what are some of the considerations that come into play as you're trying to design these malts for craft brewers?
So that's a good question. So we do try to stay within the stylistic boundaries of a given malt style. I mean, we're not trying to completely reinvent the malt world here. What we are trying to do, I'm a firm believer in, there is a malt house flavor. We all have our own kiln schedules. We all have our own ways that we're malting. We're using different varieties depending on what part of the country we're in. So we're trying to keep things predictable and consistent, while also offering a new approach to already existing malts. But we also, in the case of Murphy and Rood, we have actually also taken the opportunity to create some of our own malts, you know, unique to us. We have two house roasts. One is called Belgian Amber. That's a light aromatic malt. And then we also have a dry roasted rye called Blonde Rye. It's a very lightly roasted rye malt. It's kind of like a riff on chocolate malt, much lighter, but it actually accentuates rye as opposed to dampen out that rye flavor that you can get in dry roasted ryes, mainly chocolate ryes, if you've ever used any of those. And so, we're trying to put our own stamp on what we consider to be quality base, high kiln or crystal or roasted malts.
And then I assume you're getting feedback from the brewers and distillers as you go, right?
We do. I mean, I could always use more. I think, you check in with your customers like, yeah, it went really well. We loved it. The brew house smelled like a chocolate cake. I mean, those are all great. That's great feedback. We're glad our customers are happy. It can be somewhat like pulling teeth when we're trying to get, maybe some beta testing feedback. We've got a new Cara Munich style malt that we are just producing, and we're kind of slowly releasing into kind of a beta testing mode right now. So we selectively choose brewers that are, use that style often or have a production capability that allows them to pilot batch test stuff for us. But in those cases, we are pretty demanding of the feedback that we ask for. But we do get feedback. But again, I always kind of wish it was more to really see where folks think we could improve or that we should absolutely not touch it because it's perfect.
You mentioned this earlier, but obviously craft malts cost a little bit more than perhaps buying bulk commercial malts. How do you work with the breweries to properly share the story and, indeed get them to pony up the extra costs?
Yeah. So this went into, we have two ways of really, tracking this down. So one is how we, the model with which we built the malt house is a specialty malt house. It allowed brewers to select products that they want to spend a little bit extra money on, and that are more likely to be seen and smelled and tasted by their customers. So being able to provide specialty malts allows a brewer to utilize products much more prominently in a beer without the volume of base malt. So they're able to, for instance, stick to their perhaps contract price bulk base malt supply and then integrate some of our specialties in. The other is, the quintessential seasonal beers, the one-off releases. But what we're finding the most is that the added price of craft malt does not make a material difference in the taproom price. I mean, if you raise your pint by a quarter, you'll probably still make 10, 15 cents on it. And so really the ability to raise beer prices, I suppose, is there. I don't necessarily think it is cost prohibitive not to. But it's also about where your production is. I mean, we could not service a silo, for instance, so we're not actually looking for a silo contract, for instance, in our base malts. We have a very good mixture of breweries that are, nearly exclusive users of all of our malts. We're their primary malt supplier. We have others that use us for very select releases over the course of the year, whether it's an anniversary release or a sour or barrel program, products that they're pushing, and everything in between. And so it's the flexibility and that ability to weave us in that really folks need to think about. I don't think anybody expects a craft brewer to make wholesale switches in their malt supply to integrate a more localized, you know, craft malt supply chain. And I don't think that we would be able to service that anyways.
Yeah. But I mean, do you find that the craft breweries participate in telling the story? You know, the story about locally brewed ingredients, locally brewed or locally made malts?
Yeah. So, and the other way we help move this is we really try to provide tools and marketing tactics that can help our customers tell the story that they want to tell to their customers. And so, we do a lot of, you know, sensory experiences. We do that with beer festivals. We can do that with a given customer and do a side-by-side steep out of the grist bill next to the finished beer and really be able to show people where the malts played in the finished product. I think that is a really important dot connector, if you will, to the general public and really understanding the role malts play in finished beer. But we also then have tools like a tabletop that was you know, better utilized pre-COVID when tap rooms were busier. But we have essentially a tabletop flip.
I assume, just a little flip chart or something.
A little flip chart but it walks us through. You know, it'll walk folks through the small grain agriculture in Virginia, harvest year report, so to see how the weather impacted the grain supply that then impacts the malt supply. We walk through, you know, a page on each malt that that particular brewery uses, and then we, you know, highlight some of our farms that can then link to videos that are on our website. And so it allows somebody at a tabletop or at a bar, once they open up again, I hope soon, to be able to sit there, and rather than scrolling through their phone, they can scroll through this tabletop flip chart and really learn a little bit more about both the beer that they're drinking as well as what the brewery they're at is utilizing in a local supply chain.
Now, Jeff, you at the beginning, you mentioned you got into this because of a discussion over distilleries, and you do supply several different distilleries. How are the needs of the distilleries different, perhaps, than the needs of the craft breweries?
It depends on the spirit being made. I mean, if you're an all grain a grain distiller, so you know, the best example being that of bourbon distillers who are using a very high percentage of raw unmalted adjuncts, their malt requirements are much different. They need a much more highly enzymatic base malt to convert obviously both that malt starch as well as the raw unmalted adjunct starches, so that of corn or raw wheat or raw rye, that malt carries that whole mash bill. And so the need is much different from an enzymatic package standpoint. When we're talking to a single malt whiskey distiller, for instance, they're using a product much similar to what a brewer's using. They're looking more for flavor profile as well as yield. And so that's giving that's much more in line with what we're producing on a daily basis for brewers.
So how do you change your recipe, if you will, to adopt to the different ones?
Yeah. So a grain distiller's malt would be a very high protein, barley that, you know, we spend all this time trying to get growers to control the amount of protein that's in their finished grain. This particular malt, because enzymes are proteins, to get a higher enzymatic package, you need a higher protein barley going into the process to begin with. Once you have that, it also begins with a longer germination period. We germinate that barley to an extent that the enzyme package is at its highest point, and then we kiln it at the lowest temperatures possible to actually preserve all enzymes. In a typical brewer-based malt, even a Pilsner or a pale, you're getting up to temperatures that are, you're losing, you're denaturing a little bit of the enzyme package in those products, but you don't need as much in a brewing application. So that grain distiller's malt is very high-powered malt that is produced more for enzymes than, let's say, flavor development in the kiln.
Interesting. You also do some home brewing on the premises, right? To try out your malts. Can you share us some of the beers that you've developed in the brewery using your own malts, perhaps to highlight some of the characteristics?
Yeah, I mean, I figure it's always important to test your own wares, if you will. So we do utilize, it's just a small 5 to 10 gallon homebrew batch tradition at the malt house that allows us to really R&D either new malts that we're developing or want to tweak or malts that we just want to make sure that we are, always familiar with how they are going to play in a different beer application. A lot of our specialty malts, particularly our house roasts, we want to brew different beers so we can teach brewers where to best utilize those malts because they're not used to them on the open market. So, most recently we brewed a really low ABV, delicious corn lager with some heirloom corn that we'd been piloting, this past year, testing out things like a Baltic Porter with our blonde rye. I also think, blonde rye would play really well in like an Irish red to really, play up if let's say a brewery has an Irish red as a flagship that's on tap all year round, to really differentiate that as a flagship beer as opposed to just kind of a common Irish red that is brewed for drinkability. And so testing whether we could maybe integrate our aromatic malt Belgian amber into a double IPA, for instance, to really bring out some of that malt backbone when these are getting relatively heavily hopped to counteract the higher ABV. So it's important for us to be able to convey where malts will and will not work in a given recipe.
Do you actually sell the homebrewers? That was another question I had.
We did. We originally were just going direct to consumer, via our website. We did eventually move to homebrew supply, certainly locally only. Our local homebrew supply store carries our whole line here, which is great. It gives full access to homebrewers in our area. Admittedly, homebrew supply stores can be difficult to get into. The margins are not the greatest in a homebrew supply store, and they're also bringing in a lot of SKUs because there's a lot of different malts when we start talking about all of the European producers and all of the recipes that specify a particular brand and a particular type, in which case the homebrewer may not want to necessarily deviate from that. So homebrew supply stores are really trying to give homebrewers all the options that they could potentially need. That doesn't always leave a lot of rack space for craft malts, and that they may be outside of the price point that a homebrew supply store is willing to sell them at. Or in some cases, we've heard that some homebrew supply proprietors just don't think that the homebrew crowd will really care about local ingredients, which at least here locally in Charlottesville, we have proven to be completely and totally wrong. So I'm glad to myth bust that one. But we certainly wish we could be in more homebrew stores. It's difficult when we can't, we don't have a lot of local or at least mid-Atlantic online store presence. We don't have a lot of those outfits around here. So, it's always it's kind of been a moving target going on, but we always try to make our stuff available to people passing through town on their way to other events or to see family or so on and so forth. They can swing by and grab a bag of this and that. We try to sell in smaller amounts in some of our darker or lower percentage, grist percentage malts. So like our Dark Crystal, for instance, we try to sell those in 25-pound bags. So we just don't have stuff sitting around and makes it a little bit more accessible.
And you're at Charlottesville, and your website for folks that are interested?
It is murphyrudemalting.com. No and.
Okay.
Websites don't like ampersands, come to find out. So, yeah. And to learn more about our MillFresh campaign, it's murphyrudemalting.com/MillFresh. We would love people to share their use of local or regional ingredients with our hashtag MillFresh to really bring attention to people thinking about what they're using in their beer and how they are getting different and I'm sure better results with local producers that are really producing some of the freshest stuff available.
And Jeff, I wanted to get your closing thoughts after going through the whole startup process and then 2 years as a craft maltster.
It's a hustle. I mean, the stuff, I never went into this thinking that if I build it, they would come. I'm glad I didn't. That's certainly not the case. But if you market it hard enough and you really help convey a story, you help convey a value. That's really what I've found to be an important component of craft malt. And then once we get our products into the brew house, they usually speak for themselves from there on out. So I think we have a lot of happy customers that may have either been waiting for us to be able to provide these smaller batch products, or perhaps were not sure if a small guy like us could pull it off like the big guys, and are presently surprised that we can. And so, brewing is a peer-driven industry. And so we also enjoy in the collaborative environment that breweries are often working in, having their buddy say they really like our stuff is usually a really good kick in the pants for that brewer to place an order of their own.
Well, Jeff, really appreciate you taking the time to come on the show today. It's been great having you as a guest.
Yeah, thank you, Brad. This has been great. Thanks for the time.
And my guest today was Jeff Bloom. He's the founder and headmaster at Murphy & Rude Malting Company, located in Charlottesville, Virginia. Thanks again.
Thank you.
A big thank you to Jeff Bloom for joining me this week. Thanks also to Craft Beer & Brewing Magazine. They offer access to videos, brewing courses, exclusive articles, and the amazing Craft Beer & Brewing Magazine. Go to beerandbrewing.com to get your subscription today. Again, that's beerandbrewing.com. And also the Brew Commander, the new brew house controller from Blickman Engineering. It's available in electric and gas propane models. The patent-pending Brew Commander is a high-quality brew house controller that offers automated step mashing, boil timers, precision temperature control, and advanced settings. Command your brew day with the new Brew Commander. To order yours today, go to blickmanengineering.com. For more information, again, that's blickmanengineering.com. And finally, I urge you to give Beersmith 3 Brewing Software a try. If you've not downloaded the new 3.1 update, grab it now as it includes improved data storage, additional dry hop options, new mash pH models, new add-ons, and much more. To download your free 21-day trial, go to beersmith.com today. Again, that's beersmith.com. I'd like to thank you for listening, and I hope you have a great brewing week.